Blog Talk Radio.
The island of Mauritius is 45 kilometers east to west, 67 kilometers north to south. It is located in the Indian Ocean and is often referred to as the star of the Indian Ocean. Mauritius is about 2,000 kilometers off the southern coast of Africa, a little bit east of Madagascar. Once this beautiful and uninterrupted island was home to a waddling, strange, apparently delicious animal. This animal was the dodo bird. The dodo bird is technically a very large pigeon. It's in the pigeon family. This bird is about 3 feet tall and weighed up to 40 or 50 pounds. This bird, in its natural state, lived a long and calm life. The dodo bird had no natural predators. It was isolated from them on that island and either lost or never fully developed the ability to fly. At some point in history, in the late 1500s, early 1600s, Western sailors discovered this beautiful and amazing island of Mauritius. And of course, the very large and curious bird that occupied it. The dodo is reported to not even have to work too hard for its meals. The dodo is said to have eaten mostly nuts and fruits that had fallen from the trees. Now, the dodo bird did have one weapon in its arsenal. And that weapon is it did have a very big, powerful beak. However, this bird did not move well, so it was extremely easy to catch and to outmaneuver. It is said that the dodo had a slow, clumsy, waddle-like walk, and that this bird was a terrible runner. So for having no natural predators, this bird didn't even run very well for being a land bird. The dodo bird, being isolated from its natural predators, also developed a fearless and trusting nature. When the first Dutch sailors arrived in the late 1500s, early 1600s, the dodo bird showed no fear of the humans. And with their inability to fly and not maneuver well, this made them very easy prey. The sailors then brought other animals with them, dogs, cats, rats, pigs, even monkeys that would raid the dodo's nest, taking the eggs. The eggs of a dodo bird were laid just sort of right on the ground. It's almost as if this creature was set up for extinction. And dodos are an animal that produce a low number of offspring. So, the story goes a little something like this. Once upon a time, there was a pigeon. This giant pigeon was 3 feet tall, weighed about 40 to 50 pounds. This animal had no natural predators, did not run well, could not fly, laid its eggs on the ground, and did not produce a large number of eggs. After centuries or millennia of evolution, as time passes, these creatures are discovered by Dutch sailors in or close to the year 1600. By the year 1680, only 80 years after the Dutch sailors had arrived at Mauritius, this bird becomes extinct. There are no more dodo birds on planet Earth. Today we will be discussing cryptozoology, animals that have been extinct, animals that are being or have yet to be discovered, and animals that are being searched for. So join us right here on Main Street Universe. All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Main Street Universe.
Good morning, everyone.
The day after Election Day.
Yeah.
Speaking of extinct or rare animals, one might say an honest politician. Category.
Yes. So glad Obama won.
And it was, I was at work. I heard that the president was reelected after I got off work. Of course, this isn't a political show, but it's still okay to discuss these things.
Yes.
I've always said if I'd done a political show, it would be much easier.
Very
easy to wake up and complain about what bothers me. In the
yeah.
Rather than formulating different topics. But, yep, Barack Obama did win again for a second term. I did vote yesterday. I rode my bike.
So did I. I'm glad I voted.
A few miles down the road. It was funny because there was an angry pollster there. There was a guy that was working the polls, and some lady came in with a button on, and he said, "Ma'am, you're going to have to remove that button." And all the other people were there saying, "No, she really doesn't." And he got all huffy about it.
Yeah.
Because he was confused about, he was one of the workers there, but he was confused about the law. And you're allowed to wear a T-shirt or a button when you go in to vote. You're just,
yes, you are.
You're just not supposed to actually be doing, you know, electioneering, or you're not supposed
yeah.
to be campaigning and handing people flyers and things like that when you're in that space. In the,
yes.
booth room. At least that's how it works in Virginia and I think Maryland. So, and he kept saying it and he kept getting all huffy about it. It was so funny. He's like, "If I had known that, I would have worn my MR. I'd been covered in my MR, Mitt Romney."
Oh. I don't know why he didn't know that. When I went polling, there was a lot of people with buttons on that.
Of course.
That worked on the poll. They passed out either the Democratic or the Republican papers. The
oh, yeah. And outside of the actual election area, whatever room it is, I know there's different places, there's school gyms and there's courthouses and all this and all these other places where people vote. Outside of the actual polling place, anybody's allowed to hand you anything they want.
Correct.
Just like there's a misinterpretation, because when somebody goes campaigning door to door, people call that, if they're opposed to whoever you're for, they'll say, "Oh, you can't be soliciting here. We have no soliciting in this neighborhood."
Mm-hmm.
But free speech is protected under the Constitution, far outweighing your neighborhood associations.
Far outweighing it. Actually, we had a
solicitation agreement of whatever form it is.
A very nice man that came from Brooklyn, New York, that knocked on my door on Sunday to ask us to vote for Obama. And we had a long conversation with him. His house got was slightly affected by Hurricane Sandy.
Mm.
So he had a lot to say about that. And but, yeah, anybody could knock on your door when it's political time. When it's not political time, that's a different story.
But I think, yeah, when it's matters of free speech politically, what the First Amendment's truly for, your right to do things for campaigns or for issues are fully protected.
Yes.
In that aspect, as far as versus no solicitation style things. But anyway, in all fairness, Romney did give a very nice sort of session or congratulation speech to Obama after finding out that Barack Obama was most likely going to be the winner. So I don't know if you heard that as well, but it was actually,
yes, I did.
It was actually pretty nice.
Yeah, it was very dignified.
Mm-hmm.
I was up until 3 o'clock this morning, so I'm kind of like, but I'm waking up as we speak.
Sure. So today's topic is cryptozoology. Cryptozoology is the study of animals that have been extinct, or animals that are new species to be discovered. And it is as well considered in part a study of animals that people are sort of in the search for, or that are curious if they actually existed. Unicorns, Bigfoot, and other examples, chupacabra, can fit into this idea, this life science of the study of the pursuit of animals that fall into one of these three basic categories. So I'm going to go ahead and get started here with Mapinguari, Yeti, Sasquatch, Yeren, Yowie, Bigfoot. For centuries in North America and elsewhere, Native people have passed down stories of the hairy man of the woods or of the mountains. He has been called the Stone Man by the Cherokee, the Big Elder Brother by the Sioux. In 908 Common Era, Viking Leif Erikson reported encountering the hairy man of the woods in North America. The first recorded modern non-native sighting being in 1924, a group of miners claimed that they encountered a large, hairy, ape-like creature, and they actually killed it, according to their report. Later that night, they said that their lodge was under attack by more of these creatures who were hurling large stones at them. They did survive the encounter. It is said that this was a family of these creatures living in the mountains, perhaps seeking revenge or just trying to scare them off. It is important to note that very, very rarely has anyone reported an act of aggression or any violent behavior towards them from a Sasquatch or Bigfoot. This brings me to the next portion of our discussion. Sasquatch. The word Sasquatch actually has kind of a curious history. Many people assume that it's a Native American word for the Bigfoot creature.
I did.
And in part it is. And I'll explain. Sasquatch is a term coined by J.W. Burns. J.W. Burns was a teacher on a reservation in Canada beside the Harris River, about 60 miles east of Vancouver, British Columbia. And he wrote many articles and stories that were published in local Vancouver newspapers of the day. One of these publications was a popular magazine called McLean's. The word Sasquatch was printed for the first time in this publication. It is thought that the word Sasquatch was one of two things. One is that it was a native word that J.W. Burns mispronounced. It was thought that there was just a word that just, he did teach on reservation, so he was around First Nation people a lot, but he may have misinterpreted the word. The other theory is that it wasn't a mispronunciation. Since he was an educated guy, he might have gone to the lengths of it not being a mispronunciation, in that it was, in fact, a word that he sort of put together out of, because there were many different groups and tribes that had their different words for, the forest father, the hairy man of the mountain, the big elder brother of the woods. And it was like a combination word. He just kind of patched it together to kind of, I guess, unify it a little bit and kind of come up with his own way of saying it. So it was either a word he sort of came up with by piecing together other Indian words, or it was a mispronunciation. I'm kind of going with the fact, since he was an educated guy and a writer, that was probably the second one. He probably pieced it together. That's just my thought on the subject. But there's a little side note about the origins of the word Sasquatch. And J.W. Burns did collect some interesting information. The elder natives had mentioned that these wild, hairy men of the woods lived in caves in the mountains. Some speculate that one of the reasons why these large, very large, 10-foot-tall, hairy creatures that are loud, with a loud howl, can stay so elusive, can stay so secretive, is that they may have intricate networks of caves.
That they're living in.
Yes, in which they travel, and they can go from place to place, pop up on the other side of the mountain. So by using these networks of caves to travel, they can have themselves sort of rarely seen by outsiders. And they usually come out at night. They're considered, they've always been considered to be nocturnal to hunt. So they're in the cover of caves by day, either sleeping or doing some of their traveling, and then only coming out under the cover of night to get food. Yeah, I see Veronica and Marcy are here.
Hi, Veronica and Marcy.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
We've started our cryptozoology discussion and into Bigfoot at this point, and we'll get on to other animals as well. Now, as we move a little bit into the future, after the early settler and miner encounters and Viking encounters with Sasquatch, we'll move on to some of the more modern ones. In 1958, a construction worker, Jerry Crew, came across some enormous footprints in Humboldt, Cali, California, where Evan went to school, actually, out there in Humboldt.
Humboldt.
Known
Ooh.
For various things that are green and people smoke them.
What's that? No, I'm kidding.
University. A local newspaper covers the story. The first paragraph of the story mentions Old Bigfoot. So from that newspaper article, the name began to kind of stick. You know, got a little circulation, and the name kind of stuck. It became the pop culture phenomenon that was to follow. And in my case, I remember being a kid in the 1970s, the popularity of Bigfoot, showing up in TV, cartoons, comics, things. And as proof of my being a child of the 1970s and 80s, I do remember Bionic Bigfoot from the show.
Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, I remember that too.
It was actually Andre the Giant, the pro wrestler.
He was definitely a big guy, big man.
And I happened to stumble across a YouTube clip of that, and I was like, there was truly some corny shows on television as a kid. And let us also serve as a reminder that there were specific times in the 80s where in Hollywood there was a writer's strike.
Yes.
And I believe one of the results of that was the A-Team. But not But onward, let's look at some other areas of the world. In the Himalayas, in 1951, Eric Shipton, at 19,000 feet, took pictures of fresh Yeti tracks, saying that no man, or maybe no Western man, might be more accurate, had ever stood there before. They were large, Bigfoot-like tracks in the Himalayas, and he did have pictures. In the Himalayas, Yeti is the word used for a Sasquatch-like creature in the region of Nepal and Tibet. It is the Himalayan Yeti, who later comes to be known as the Abominable Snowman. In China, the being is called Yeren. In Australia, the Sasquatch is called Yowie. In South America, it's Mapinguari. And the list goes on and on and on and on. Every culture seems to have its own Bigfoot or its own sort of secret big hairy wood or mountain creature that's kind of elusive. All through the 1970s and forward, there have been continued Bigfoot sightings, encounters. There's one famous case of a sighting in Western Michigan where a girl and her father ran off the road after seeing a Bigfoot in the road. And the police go to investigate it. This one kind of made police records, which got a little notoriety, and they found, like, the big footprints nearby. And in 1972, three men, Alan Berry, Rick Murphy, Tim Sawyer, claimed to have recorded what they say are the calls of a Bigfoot. They were loud howling and growling noises. And these stories continue to today. Even at work one time, one of my coworkers at the end of the night, as a joke, put on a tape that was supposedly Bigfoot noises. There's people still coming out with these all the time on some of these shows and on different websites.
What did it sound like?
A lot of them, they sound like just a, sort of a howling and a growling. Some of them have high-pitched qualities to them. Some would say that there is no proof that's testable that a Bigfoot or Sasquatch or Yeti exists. So let us examine some of the evidence in outline form for ourselves. We have, of course, number one, eyewitness testimony, which is, it is what it is, right?
Yes.
You never know. Lots of it, though. But also, as part of this, are ancient legends of indigenous people, which I think makes it kind of interesting. And in the interviews that J.W. Burns was doing way back when, of Native tribes in Canada, they were even saying, we don't want to tell you this because you're just going to make, you know, white man's going to make fun of us kind of a thing, you know. But they really viewed it as a very real thing. Of course, you have the footprint evidence and some photographic evidence, for however reliable that is, and some film evidence. And the skeptics, of course, will say as well that if Bigfoot or a man-like or human-like, ape-like, erect, two-foot walking person is out there, then why are there no remaining tools, structures, weapons? I have heard this as a debate before when looking up the different resources on this. And why are there none of these remains of tools or weapons behind? Because they're saying, well, if they have hands like a human, then they should be constructing weapons and tools and structures. As far as I know, nobody has found things like this unless somebody out there has different information. But my point of that is, anyway, it's sort of projecting your own humanness upon them. You're like saying, well, if they're like us, why aren't they? You know,
why aren't they around? Why can't we see them?
Or why aren't they leaving tools behind?
Or the skeletons.
Instructions. And that's the next argument, is where are the bones? Now, it is true that some people, especially with the Yeti, have claimed to have hides or scalps. There's one that's, I believe, in a Buddhist temple somewhere that's supposed to be like a scalp or a partial hide of a Yeti from the Himalayas. But as far as the bones and remains, you're talking about an animal that's less common, or a being that's less common. And even animals that are extremely common to these mountains, like a bear or bobcat or mountain lion, you rarely find like full remains.
That's so true.
Because nature has its own cleanup system. And so even for common animals, now it can happen. You can stumble across the carcass and remains. But, I mean, how often does it happen? It doesn't happen that often, even for animals that are highly abundant in that area. So the people who are sort of on the pro-Sasquatch side would say that nature's cleanup system, combined with the fact that it's kind of a rare being anyway,
yes,
would be the reason why we don't find Bigfoot remains and bones. And some people have claimed to come forward with some Bigfoot bones, but to how legit they are, I don't really know. So I guess on our comment here on Bigfoot, and I don't know about, I won't say conclusion, but my point here on this, if Bigfoot was and is real, and if he was a violent predator, we probably would have discovered him and much more about this creature at a much faster rate, because predators, you know, they kind of leave more of a trace.
More of a carbon imprint.
Yeah, and they just leave a basic, you know, there's all these dead animals all over the place. I mean, you would just see, it would be easier if there was like, hey, what's happening to all of our, you know, cows or something, if it was coming in and eating livestock or something of this nature. But most accounts that you'll hear of Bigfoot or the Big Elder Brother is usually with only a few exceptions, and including with the native myths about this being, is that he's a peaceful creature who mostly feeds on vegetation.
Yeah, Harry and the Hendersons. I remember that movie.
I don't think I saw that one. And Sasquatch is rightfully wise to be careful in how much he reveals of himself to humans. This is a large, powerful being that lives in harmony with nature. So this could be why it's so hard to actually find one and get a good, clear picture. You have a few of these videos out there. But this is a being that, according to reports and legend, hides in caves and gathers food at night. It's large and loud and strong, but it leaves nature as he or she finds it. This being is non-territorial and will probably yield ground quickly to any intruder. Its first instinct is to hide, according to reports. Bigfoot is nomadic as well. So again, another thing making it hard to really pin down, you know, where are these things? And some have speculated, taking it to another level, that it is in fact a spiritual being, allowing itself to be seen by those who deserve to see it. I, for one, think that the natives are telling the truth in their stories of the forest father or the big elder brother. And if Sasquatch wishes to remain in the shadows, moving gently through the forest and caves away from human affairs, I can't rightfully blame them.
Don't blame him either.
So people are still debating this. There is supposedly some new film footage that's supposed to be recent and supposed to be really good. I personally haven't seen it. I've seen a bunch of them when researching the show. Someone pointed out a new one to me that I didn't get a chance to check out.
Interesting.
So our first animal we discussed is Sasquatch. Lots of eyewitness and story evidence, lots of myth around this being. A few physical things, a few claimed hides and stuff like that. Of course, the footprints, which can be easily faked. But
easily.
Some of the stories surrounding the footprints were interesting, though. There was one scientist who was saying that he can tell the difference between real and fake ones and his claim to debunk fake ones. So outside of that, not a lot of physical evidence for the Bigfoot, but definitely a lot of interesting myth. And another animal I'd like to start to discuss, I guess Janice is one of her favorites, would be an extinct animal. We started off with the dodo bird in the introduction. Saber-toothed tiger. You are coughing a lot today.
Yeah. My nose is running. So, yeah, the saber-toothed tiger, also known as the simian. And that's from Greek culture. That means smiling carved teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not. Actually, they're called a simian. The saber-toothed tiger is one of the things that came up with after one was captured. Now, they were in the planet about 9 million years ago, and they derived their name of saber-tooth due to the fact that their teeth were extended from the side of their mouth, as high as 20 inches from the top of the mouth down. And they're part of the, and I hope I say this right, the Makachere, Dananae. Let me spell it for you because I know I murdered it. Machairodontinae. Genus of carnivorous mammals. They were on the planet, like I said previously, about 9 million years ago. And they were roughly survived many stages of the planet, including the Ice Age, the last Ice Age, which was 10,000 years ago, before driven into extinction, supposedly by prehistoric humans. Now,
I've heard from climate change.
I heard from climate change as well.
That also killed off the things that they preyed on. They preyed on big, slow mammals. Kind of like modern tigers, even though technically they're saying saber-toothed tiger is not exactly a tiger, but it's in the cat family.
It's in the cat family.
And modern tigers, too, they'll pick, like, a baby of a big animal. So they get a big animal still, but it's maybe, you know, clumsier or slow or not as bright or quick. But go ahead.
Well, yeah, they were saying that they were into very big prey, like elephants, rhinos, hippos, more the baby of that species, because, you know, a full-grown elephant is much faster than people realize. But they were definitely into big prey, and not so much human prey like the old Hollywood B movies. They were definitely more into huge baby species of bison, elephants, hippos, rhinos, that sort of thing. They're more related to, if you want to call the bobcat or the mountain lion, but most of the things I've seen, they look like really big indoor cats, if you want to say that. Their bodies weren't as long as the body of an average tiger or lion. They're more of a smaller indoor cat or a bobcat, if you can recall what a bobcat looks like. A bobcat and a saber-tooth tiger, even though they weren't really tigers, look very similar, with the short legs and the powerful teeth, but the very long breech with the arms and the long teeth. And they were very powerful. They say more powerful than an average lion. And they would use the long teeth to puncture on the side of the neck of the prey and would either bite into their trachea, or what's called a trachea, or bite into their jugular vein. And that's how they would kill the prey. And then they would take the prey off and eat it. But there's been it's not an unknown species. There's a lot of different bones that are in the Smithsonian, in the American Museum of Natural History. And there's also, I remember seeing some saber-toothed tiger bones when I was in London 2 years ago. So it's not like it's a fantasy animal. It's very much an animal that walked on this planet for many years before it had died out through climate change. And they were talking about, they also had, besides the big long teeth in the front of their mouth, they had a lot of different teeth that would be very similar to the teeth of a human, which I found very fascinating. And they would have the very long kind of tapered teeth on the side of their mouth, but they would have canines and baby teeth like a human. That was really fascinating. And also they were very social animals that when they weren't hunting for the evening meal, they were very much into being around other animals. Even being around humans before, they were slaughtered for their meat and for their fur. But they were actually acting a lot like a modern-day cat when we come into a place and meet friends and then get very unsocial and go to the side and do whatever, do their own thing. And it was also very good cats for long-distance travel. They would go very long distances to find food and to find other saber-toothed cats that were around.
Yeah, and they would occasionally scavenge, but most of the time they hunted from one of their tricks that I read about saber-toothed tiger is they would hide in like lower tree branch and just
marshes.
Pounce on animals, and like you said, get them with the throat with those fangs. I also heard that those teeth, those long canine fangs that a saber-tooth has, are more delicate than people might think. They actually would sometimes break off, and they were kind of meant for that specific, maybe like that sort of vampire.
yeah. It kind of reminds me of vampire claw.
So delicate, and they had to guard against them breaking off.
Now, and there's some reasons why some researchers think they went as instinct. The climate change, that's a really big one. Even before the humans came, there was a lot of climate changes. Unlike the average cheetah or lion, their bodies were more closer to the ground and their legs were shorter. So they couldn't run or leap as fast as what you would see a tiger or a panther or a lion would leap. And since they were actually more lower to the ground, that made it easier prey for the prehistoric lions to actually eat them as well. And they also said that starvation, when they couldn't find the bigger elephants or bisons or hippos or whatever.
Or sloth,
yes, because they ate a lot of sloth. That was part of why they became extinct. They really didn't go after humans. Humans will be the kind of the last resort for food. So if they're looking for a much bigger animal,
yes,
and they didn't go after the humans, then that could cause the starvation as well.
As slow-witted as humans can be, they went after even larger, slower, and more slow-witted animals.
Yes.
Like the sloth and the other things you mentioned as well. And, yeah, I've seen also, Marcy mentioned the Museum of Natural History as well, which, you know, we live close by here.
They're very close by, yes.
Always great. I loved going to see the dinosaur exhibits and all that as a kid. And
they were, on this particular essay, they were talking about how they used their fur to camouflage themselves while they were hunting. Because it's usually kind of a light brown, almost light orange type of fur.
Yeah.
That would look very close to what a ground would look like, the dirt on the ground. So if they were in a marsh waiting for their prey, they could easily be camouflaged so they can go out and hunt. And they use their whiskers, like cats use them, so they can sense things, especially their touch, after things became very dark.
Mm.
And most of the bones that they find, when they do find them, are in the Rancho La Brea tar pits in California. Instead of, there's a lot of bones of the saber-toothed tiger there. And it believed that they lived about 1.1 million years ago, but only became extinct about 10,000 years ago.
Yeah, after the changing of the ice ages,
mm-hmm.
Another one of those great early mammals. And you know what's a funny fact that I didn't even realize until I started researching some of these animals, is that the gorilla wasn't discovered until the 19th century.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I didn't realize it was that recent of a discovery. So is that...
Yeah. And one of the reasons why I picked the saber-toothed tiger is I thought it was really related to the Black Panther, because I love Black Panthers. I just think they're just the cat's meow, so to speak. Long and lean and powerful. Now, they do have similar teeth, even though the teeth of the panther doesn't project out like the saber tooth. But they did have similar, very, very agile, sharp teeth to destroy a person's trachea or the jugular vein. But what I have found out is that the Black Panther is fastly becoming a very endangered species. And that's really a shame, because they're such beautiful animals.
Yeah, the Black Panther is, I believe, on the endangered species list at this time until, like, further notice. Sometimes these animals come off the list, you know.
Yes.
Sometimes things are done and measures are taken.
Yeah. But they're on the list because basically their fur, being like, long and sleek and black and really beautiful. Also for their meat, but mostly for their fur.
And now we're going to go to a little bit more aquatic. And in 1565, pretty long time ago.
Long time.
A sainted monk mentions the Loch Ness Monster.
Ah, Nessie.
It has pretty early mentioning there, what some people are calling a surviving plesiosaur. And there was one, there's been many photos claimed to be Loch Ness Monster. Here's a bit that I'll go into. Tim Tinsdale, 1960, took a film of the Loch Ness Monster, and it was the first one to be taken seriously by other scientists that were outside of the, you know, monster-searching scientist community, I guess. And it was determined by the Joint Air Reconnaissance Intelligence Center at the British Defense Ministry. That sounds very United Kingdom. Conclusion, this is a living creature, 6 foot wide, 10 foot high. Another film similar came about a bit later with the same results and announced by the same group, the Joint Air Reconnaissance Intelligence Center at the British Defense Ministry, with similar results after the investigation. Now, these were ones where they were filmed, not just a still photograph, but there was movement. And I've seen the films. They look a little bit...
How good are they?
They can go either way. They're actually moving fairly fast across the water, and you're thinking, is that a little speedboat? There, in one of the films, though, that was interesting, there was a boat to compare it to. So there was another kind of slow-moving boat to say, okay... Well, it doesn't necessarily look like a speedboat, I'll give you that. At first, you're thinking, is this a little tiny speedboat?
Yeah.
You see the trail of the water going by and not a great view of what's making it. But in one of these films, they did have, there happened to be a boat nearby, just coincidentally or incidentally. And so there is a dramatic difference between, okay, what it looks like when a boat is doing this and when from the Nessie is doing this. And, of course, I'm from Baltimore, and if you remember, Chesapeake Bay has a legend of a Chesapeake
Bay monster.
Chessie. I don't remember how credible at all any of this was, or tourist gimmick. I don't remember seeing any convincing pictures of it, but I do remember the story. And there's another interesting, some sonar experiments that went on in 1969, in 1970. And in 1972, explorers made contact with three large moving objects with sonar. And these were believed, of course, to be of similar dimension and to be, of course, a plesiosaur or Loch Ness Monster. That's what a lot of the modern cryptozoologists are calling this. They think it's a surviving plesiosaurus left over that... survived all of these years.
From the dinosaur era?
Yeah, like a big dinosaur fish. There was another interesting story, a guy named John Cobb, who attempted to set a water speed record of the day. This was in 1955. A strange turbulence, unexpected, causes the thundering boat to crash. It is said that, according to many of the people there and around the incident, that they think that it scared this monster, or I'm calling it a monster, it's an animal. It scared this animal. You get too caught up in the hype, right?
Yeah.
It scared this animal, and since it's big, it was trying to get away from the loud noise. They said this boat made a particularly loud noise. You know, he was trying to break the water speed record, and he had this really kind of obnoxious, loud, fast bow. And they said that its turbulence from trying to get away caused this enough of a wave spot in the water that caused his boat to flip over and crash. So some of the interesting things about the Loch Ness Monster is that there actually is, even though, you know, most skeptics would just say it's all BS, but... there actually is, unlike some of the other cryptids out there, and that's what they call an animal being researched in cryptozoology, is a cryptid. there is some really fairly good evidence that this thing exists. And it's also very plausible that it exists because it's a water creature. And you can go into so many different aspects of water life. There are creatures in the water that can survive in boiling water near volcanic lava. They've discovered conditions that they thought couldn't survive. And also, as many people know, many different water animals, if left alone, can grow to enormous size. You know, in Maryland, there used to be this giant crab that they used to show off. Now I think there's like a model of it somewhere.
Crab, squid, octopus.
The squid is another interesting one because in the 2000s, they did discover giant squids and octopus that were around 23 to 25 feet in length. You know, this is the mythical
Kraken. Kraken. Release the Kraken.
So it's extremely possible that an undisturbed animal can survive in the water. And it's in deep, deep, deep oceans that we'll find all this, you know, amazingly new species and do all the time. And the giant squid from the 2003 film footage that I saw, there was one in France that was about 23 feet long, one in Florida about the same. So this is interesting. The Kraken was considered real as late as the 1700s. The Kraken was included in a book on natural history of Norway, sort of like an official natural history book in Norway. So it wasn't treated like a fantasy animal at all. And this is one that evolves back into modern day. We discover it again. Mm-hmm. In that, so imagine even back then with things being disturbed even less, how big maybe one of these things could have gotten, and maybe the legends of it wrapping around the boat, you know, with its tentacles. And I think a squid would be scarier than an octopus, because if you say at a squid, they got like these, it's almost like things that can hook onto you and their prey in, and they got that big eye looking at you. And there's
a horror movie in the making.
And there's two things that are like longer than its tentacles. So
don't they have suction? Like,
the octopus has those. They're also highly intelligent animals, the octopus are. I remember seeing one scientific theory that was on a show where they were saying that it was one of the other animals that could evolve into the most intelligent species on the planet could be an octopus. Have you ever seen them escape from their aquatic cages? They put them in these aquariums, and you see an octopus escape out and jump back into the water. It's pretty fun to watch that, and to watch them go through that. So when you're dealing with aquatic life, so many things are possible. And what does separate the Loch Ness Monster or the plesiosaur from, say, Bigfoot or, say, from some of these other animals that are considered the realm of myth is there has been study of it from groups outside of, say, you know, like shows like Monster Hunters, shows that aren't those kind of people. I mean, not shows, but groups that aren't those folks, just cryptozoologists. They've been studied by, you know, the British Air Force. They've been studied by other serious outside scientists doing sonar. Some of the people stumbled across it accidentally that didn't necessarily have an interest in finding it. Then there are the other eyewitness accounts. The other issue with this, even though it has a little more validity and credibility to it, there's been people that have come straight out and admitted they've committed a hoax, that have taken Loch Ness Monster pictures. This has happened in all of these realms, though. Big UFOs, there are people that have, you know, thrown, you know, pie plates in the air and said, oh, no, that was, look, here's what I did. The same is true with Nessie, which, of course, you know, leads to more skepticism. But the Loch Ness Monster is one where some pretty interesting evidence has turned up, including one of the sonar findings of a plesiosaur was a more modern and advanced one that was done. And this was Dr. Rhines. And he had a computer-operated sonar and camera, and it was set on a trigger. So when something passed by this sensor, the camera went off and the sonar went off, and he had multiple things trying to record this in the water. And he actually had some really nice, clear pictures. Maybe I'll put them on the wall later. of like an actual fin that looks like the back of a plesiosaur fin. Now, as of yet, of the research I saw, nobody has debunked this yet. But you know how sometimes these things can change rapidly. But
yes.
This one looked pretty good. You know, it's in the very dark, murky waters of Loch Ness, which is difficult to photograph anything anyway. So this fin had to have been pretty close to the equipment, probably to be
very close, like right next to it.
It's a pretty good picture. It really does look like a fin. It's not all hazy. I mean, it's a little bit hazy because it's under the water in Loch Ness,
mm-hmm.
but it's not as bad as some other evidence of this type. And this guy seemed like a pretty respectable scientist, and who set up probably the most modern attempt that I've seen thus far. At one time, there were cameras pointed all over Loch Ness, and this fin was about 8 feet long. It was pretty big. That's what they were guessing by the sonar and by the measurements and by how far away they thought it was. They were thinking this was about an 8 foot long giant fin that was passing by. So there's been some slightly better evidence for this particular cryptid, if you will, than for some of the other ones, as well as its possibility. I think once you start talking about the aquatic cryptids, well, they're discovering new aquatic species all the time. And discovering other large, I mean, very large, and that's when it always, I think, makes an impression, because you're thinking, how do we not notice something so big, you know?
Yeah.
Including, there's a story in New Zealand of a whale that washed ashore. It was actually a mother and son whale.
Okay.
These two whales washed ashore, and they were thought to be extinct. This was a whale that they thought had not been with us for a long, long, long time. And this is just recently. This is within 2011 or 2012. This is, no, I'm sorry, 2010. So in 2010, this
very recent
space-toothed whale with a beak, the spade-toothed-beaked whale. The only evidence we had prior to this was three partial skulls. So they didn't have even a whole lot before, but they knew of its existence. And these skulls were in New Zealand, and I believe one was in Chile. And it's considered one of the world's rarest living animals, if in fact there's more of them after these two, if these weren't the last two. So this was an animal thought to be extinct for a long time, and it's the spade-toothed beaked whale. They thought it was a slightly more common gray-beaked whale, turned out not to be, and they're thinking this is a pretty legitimate find of another aquatic animal that had thought to have been long gone, with not even much evidence of its original existence floating around.
So they captured the whale and maybe whale?
It was not captured. It washed ashore.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it just pretty much was just turned up one day on the shores of New Zealand, in Opaque Beach, New Zealand. And we'll get back to this in just a minute, folks. I'm going to take a brief little break and maybe go inside and get a cup of coffee, if we are blessed enough to do so. My brother and his wife are having some kind of meeting in there. So here's a group of local hippies I ran into. And I bought their CD, and they were truly just traveling around. Oh, I see Marcy's posted some stuff just for
fun. Oh, she has a lot of stuff posted.
Caverns, it's only possible. Yes, I agree completely. It's probably one of the most possible out of all of the cryptids of that people are putting into a fantasy category.
Yes.
It's when you start getting into the aquatic animals, it's...
Well, the ocean has many secrets.
And this one was Euphoric Vibration, they were calling themselves. I ran into these kids at an open mic on Sunday. The guy plays this giant stick, and I can't remember the name of the instrument. It's a giant stick with like a million strings, and you play it like a piano. Maybe somebody out there knows what the name of this instrument is. And it sounds like he's got a bass player and everything else going on. Maybe at some point there's some of that on this recording, but it's just him playing this thing and his girlfriend or wife. They're traveling up and down the East Coast. They're from Florida. And I said, hey, how much for the CD? And he was like, whatever makes you comfortable, man, whatever you want to pay.
All right, man.
He's very laid back. And I said, all right, I'll see you and I'll put it on my show. So here it is. This one's called Let It Shine.
dead inside. Each and every one of us is a flowing fountain of life. Let it shine. Let it shine. All of the time, all over everything you do. Let love guide the way. Let it brighten up the day now. Let it let it shut up, the bump, don't do the bump, don't do the bump, don't do the bump, don't do. If you're lost in the dark and if you can't sing, if you're shivering in the cold night, turn up the heat. You got a fire burning deep inside. You got a
themselves Euphoric Vibration, and it was, she was painting the, or painting or drawing up, I mean, the CD covers, because she was selling CDs there, had it set up in the pub, and she was just kind of drawing them as she went along, and I picked one because she was drawing it, and drawing it, and it was kind of cool in a way, because when she was drawing it, It was blue with yellow stars and looks almost exactly like the back of my Rider-Waite tarot deck. So I said, yeah, I think that's the one for me. So that was kind of fun. So we were talking about cryptozoology, and we were kind of going in the aquatic direction for a while. We mentioned earlier Bigfoot, the dodo bird. Then we moved on to the Loch Ness Monster and also some different aquatic life, a new old discovery of a whale that washed ashore in Opeak Beach, New Zealand, and it was the spade-toothed beaked whale. And again, this was an animal that previously, as its record of ever existing, had three partial skulls that existed in New Zealand and in Chile. And speaking of new things that are discovered, in Indonesia in 2011, there was an expedition out there where they discovered 160 species of animals, including, like there were some new little monkeys that they discovered, one with sideburns that they thought was extinct, another animal that was thought to be extinct. There was a new horned frog that was discovered. And there was as well in the Congo another very bright and colorful monkey that was discovered called the Lesula, is what the locals call it. And they said it's very shy with a very friendly looking kind of face. I saw the picture and it's very colorful. It has all sorts of colors in its fur.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty interesting looking, very friendly looking animal. And its shyness might be why it's helped it survive.
Yes. It was hiding out from predators.
As like the dodo bird, they said, was kind of fearless and would just come right up to people and was almost born to be extinct.
Mm-hmm.
when you read the story, which of course I've known, I remember as a kid, I remember reading the story of the dodo bird, and you just read it and the whole thing just sounds tragic. It's like this fat little waddling giant bird that can't really walk and run very well. It doesn't maneuver well. That breeds very few offspring.
Yes.
That lays its eggs just kind of right on the ground for all to attack.
Very tragic.
That didn't develop keen combat skills because it didn't have enemies. And even what it went after for food was basically just stuff that fell on the ground. Mm-hmm. Trees and nuts. That's what's suspected that it and how it ate. And it was it's become one of the most, for whatever reason, that has become one of the most popularly mentioned, because, of course, as I was looking up some of these animals, I was walking around at work and at other places saying, what's your favorite extinct animal, you know?
Oh.
So many people say the dodo bird. I don't know what it is about. You think just there are people's hearts going out to something that seemed purely helpless.
Mm.
No, it did actually have a weapon, though. The dodo bird actually had a pretty powerful beak. And potentially, maybe, I don't know, were they cracking things open with it for the nuts? I don't really know. But the thing is, it was such a poor maneuver ability of that bird that, you know, if it got you, I guess that beak bite really hurt, but it was,
yes,
it was pretty easy.
But it would have to get you first,
yeah,
so.
It was pretty easy. It was slow. It didn't develop, you know, sharp, you know, combat and defensive skills. And
How does it relate to a pigeon? Is it like
a pigeon, or it's in that family of pigeons and doves?
Okay.
It's very like a very large pigeon, and they said it also had rough skin, which would make one think sometimes birds and animals like that, they say, maybe don't taste the best, but they certainly did eat it. I mean, they. It's also said, referring back to the dodo, and this was all on the island of Mauritius for those who weren't tuned in earlier in the 1600s. Their contact with humans was for about 80 years, and it took about 80 years to become extinct.
Yes.
But it wasn't just the humans killing them off. Sometimes that's how the story is told, and yes, they did. I mean, they called them.
Oh, yes. Humans killed off a lot of different prehistoric.
They also brought other animals with them, and those animals killed off a lot of dodos, and they think that's what really did a lot of the damage. They brought their dogs, cats, even monkeys.
Yes.
That they'd collect. These were sailors traveling all over the place and would bring, introduce new species. And these new species, of course, some of them were very predatory and were very, you know, the dodo bird was easy prey for them as well as to the humans themselves. So it was also them bringing, introducing these new species from this animal that had been isolated from predators on the island of Mauritius, which is off the coast of southeastern Africa, about, I believe they say about 2,000 kilometers, off a little bit past Madagascar. There you'll see like the big island off of that bottom coast, which is Madagascar, and then you have Mauritius, which is to the right of that, or to the east of that. And, of course, we also... We're talking about Loch Ness Monster. Giant squids, giant octopuses have been discovered, once thought to be the stuff of legend.
Mm-hmm.
And in the aquatic world, again, it's like just like you put a fish in your fish tank. If you have one big fish tank and throw your goldfish in there, he'll get nice and big. And
yes.
For
keep
75
eating it.
Cents, you'll have a pretty cool-looking, you know. I had one that was a giant black moor. You remember the black moors?
Yes.
With the big eyes, and those are always my favorite,
yes.
The little goldfish. And I just thought he was the coolest fish. I had a giant Oscar that I think will come back to haunt me one day because I wasn't able to take very good care of it. And it got that like hole in its brain and was going crazy.
Uh-oh.
I thought he was going to – he used to scare people that came over. He would start banging on the side of the aquarium because he would just pop, 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 pop. And I had nightmares about that fish.
Uh-oh.
I hope my karmic debt to that fish is
– yeah. I had a goldfish that lasted 2 years one time.
But I was unemployed, and I couldn't afford to get the new, bigger
filter. Oh, okay.
I tried fancier filters. I tried some of that, and I inherited a few, and it seemed to work for a while. But he was just a monster.
Mm.
I should have just gave him away, really.
Frankenfish, no.
And then he had that hole in his head and went nuts. And he made a serious impact on that aquarium wall when he banged into the side of it.
Mm.
You jump out. I mean, he was just something. Oscars. I had a friend that also raised those, and I think it's illegal. I don't know, but it was the mannequins. It's like a cousin of the Oscar. That's more be a bit more aggressive. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's illegal or not. But I'm not in touch with this person anymore. But I remember him saying he had aquariums of these things all over the place.
What did they look like?
Like meaner Oscars.
Okay.
Or, I think that's what that fish was called. And it one time bit somebody. Bit.
Oh.
He was like, "Nah, they're not going to bite me." And he put his finger in there.
Not a smart guy, that's for sure.
But I really enjoyed working at the pet store. I don't have aquarium or anything like that now, but I enjoyed learning about the different animals. And the cichlids have a lot of character to them, which an Oscar is sort of technically one of them. The African cichlids, they're a little bit aggressive, but they often are of the freshwater fish, some of the more attractive ones with slightly brighter colors. And, you know, we'd feed the cichlids other little fish, and they're a little bit aggressive. You have to watch what you put in the tank with them. And there's also some other new discoveries we were discussing, which included some new monkeys. There's actually 18,000 species discovered last year. So that's a pretty interesting number.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, so oftentimes these are discovered in the water, and but some still there's still new mammals popping up. They were very surprised by this Lasula, the bright-colored monkey that turned up in the Democratic Republic of Congo, because it's kind of a large mammal, and it's always, like I said before, it's always kind of interesting when it seems to get people's attention when it's a large
yes.
mammal or large land animal that people went, where's this thing been? Now, and of course, it's also important that sometimes when we say discovered, it often means somebody from the West found it.
Yes.
So now we can talk about going back to another somewhat fantasy creature, I guess, which would be the unicorn.
Yeah, my other favorite. Which is a lot more mythological than the saber-toothed tiger.
Yes, but as many of the listeners here at Main Street Universe may know or may not know, in the medieval tapestries, when you see a unicorn, oftentimes it's about this tall.
Yes.
It's like
a horse.
Like a small horse or a large dog.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, more accurately, according to some, that being a goat, being caprine. And you notice that in those tapestry pictures, so oftentimes it has the goatee beard, mm-hmm. it's got the hair around there. And this is because it was believed that the unicorns were, in fact, goats. And they were goats with one horn. And in modern times, Oberon Zell Ravenheart,
yeah, tell the story.
Who has a show on Blog Talk Radio as well and has been involved in a lot of things. The Green Egg, he's written his grimoire for the Apprentice Wizard books, which are pretty popular.
He has a wizard educational format website.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, the Gray School.
Yes, the Gray School, yes.
And, excuse me, clearing my throat. He discovered this technique of whatever he does and splices the what becomes the horn together, some little splice technique that he does, and he says is harmless to the animal, and it'll cause a single horn to grow out instead of the double grow horns that we think of associated with the average goat. I do remember him saying that for whatever reason, when it's a unicorn goat, it becomes a little bit more aggressive too.
Mm-hmm.
And so he discovered this. He used to go and show them off at Renaissance fairs and festivals. I believe the last of his unicorns have died. I don't think he has any more or is mm-hmm. trying to raise unicorns anymore. But a lot of people are surprised to find out that maybe this actually was a very real animal and that it
yes.
was a goat. And that's why when you see them in the tapestries, a lot of times, like, there's one in somebody's lap. You know, there's one that's famous that's mm-hmm. like that. They have that goat beard. But something about the elongated single horn, or maybe the type of goat that was more common to use for it, the kind of long face, it just made people think, by the way they painted it, they do look like something between a goat and a horse.
Of course, yes.
When you look at it closely,
yes.
After getting that information of what has been done in modern times.
Because a Pegasus looks more like a horse, well, or is a horse,
yeah,
but they have the horn in the front.
Yeah, Marcy was mentioning, yeah, they bind them in the early stages of their growth and fuses them together to form one horn. And it's funny, that doesn't really seem that difficult, but
yeah.
I guess no one else was really that passionate to go find horns. But Oberon Zell seemed very determined.
Yeah, very.
So a lot of, I don't know if that breaks the hearts of like 13-year-old girls everywhere to find out that it wasn't a horse.
Breaks my heart, and I'm not even 13.
Or does it seem hopeful in a way? Well, they were in some way real.
Yes.
And
very hopeful.
You almost get the impression they were like a status symbol almost, right? They show up in these royal tapestries like, oh, look, I've got a unicorn.
Yes.
Oh, like having a Lamborghini or something. So the unicorn itself, turns out, in some form, was a real animal, and they might have been actually painting something that was standing in front of them there. It just turned out to be a goat and not a horse. And there's also the idea, both now, and it's happening down south a lot now, is you're getting these giant snakes. And so some people debate, you know, how big were, you know, at one time, how big were these prehistoric snakes, and could we possibly see snakes that big again? There's been snakes reported, and reptiles reported to eat, like, small calves, and it'd have to be a pretty large animal. There was one video I stumbled across where the researcher was almost killed by this giant snake. It turned out not to be as big as he thought it was going to be, and he wasn't sure if he had the right snake. It was a snake that was terrorizing this local village, so this guy goes in there and he's like, yeah, I'll bring my team in there and we'll go get it. He may have gotten the right one. It was pretty big, but they were claiming it was eating small cows and people.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I was going to ask you, how did he get almost
killed? He did. Well, he had a crew of people with him. And
yeah.
It was wrapped around him, and it had him. I mean,
Nick?
Yeah, it had him. I mean, mm-hmm. He somehow just, with him and his partner, there was a, I can't believe only, when you watch the video, it looks ridiculous. Maybe I'll post that on Facebook. I can't believe like two people jumped on this gigantic
guy and a snake.
Him and the other guy looked like he was like 5 foot tall.
Uh-oh, like, oh, man.
He's like,
97 pounds. Oh, yeah, I got the hit all right. Ah, crush.
And I'm just saying, it really did not look well planned out. Get it? You know, it was pretty bad. Yeah, in a condom, Marcy mentions beard. That's true. Yes, it was not. It wasn't good. It certainly did not seem like good planning. And this thing was wrapped around the guy's. This was actually, yeah, this was a giant python of some sort.
Oh, not an anaconda?
But the anaconda is another one. It's, I mean, a lot of these animals will just simply try to eat anything that they think they can.
Yes.
Just like some of your fish in your fish tank will just, even if it's not particularly aggressive, will sometimes just eat a smaller fish because it can, you know. And, of course, some animals have, like, even the saber-toothed tiger, they said, would occasionally scavenge, even though it was mostly a cat and a hunter. But it wasn't always above scavenging either. But
they would occasionally take a human, but human was, like, last on the list for saber-toothed tigers.
Yeah, I remember reading that the sloth was one. And the sloth is one I haven't talked about too much about. The sloth, which was very big Ice Age animal, and the sloth was a low branch tree feeder, which would make it perfect as prey for a saber-toothed tiger.
Yes.
Would hide in low branch areas of trees and then, you know, and pounce on whatever was near. So the sloth would be pulling down. It had really sharp talons, and it would pull on the leaves. Most people think that the sloth was a vegetarian, but as we were talking about how animals will be, just like humans, maybe be opportunistic eaters at times, especially as climate change was causing issues in the Ice Age, it is believed, and again to describe, the animal was large, kind of low to the ground, fed on leaves, on trees low to the ground, as well as some speculate that some breeds of sloth would feed on, it was called a glyptodont, and the glyptodont is a large armadillo-like creature.
Mm.
It said it would kind of just flip them over and then just jab them with their large three claws. But this was sort of one specific strain of sloth that they were talking about, thinking most of them were vegetarians. It makes me wonder how much vegetation an animal that
they would have to eat, yeah.
And again, some speculated potentially it was an omnivore, but its main diet being vegetables. And again, just like the saber-toothed tiger, it's assumed that the ending of the Ice Age is killed off the giant sloth.
Yes.
As well as some human hunting as well. To go after a big, slow prey like that, I guess just don't get caught by the claws.
I got to look at a picture of that. Got to look that up.
Yeah. Yeah, I might post some of these animal images up after the show on the page, as well as maybe the video, the fin picture. So maybe remind me of that before we're done.
Okay.
The fin one was a pretty good one of the Loch Ness Monster because it was the most, one of the more modern. The guy seemed to be doing some pretty respectable research on this plesiosaur. And I might post that one as well. That one was pretty good. And maybe a picture of the sloth, which Melissa in the...
Melissa, yeah. She loves sloth.
So I decided to look that one up a little bit. And again, he was almost set up to be prey for the saber-toothed tiger because right where he liked to eat was right where that...
Where the saber-toothed tiger was, yeah.
Where they like to hide. And as a kid, I remember watching my cats. I used to have like 10 cats. I always loved cats. And, you know, some were more like indoor, soft, fat cats. And some were... I had a few that were very lean hunters that were always out there on the prowl. And I used to like just watching them do their thing. And I've always thought it was funny when I got older when people talked about a cat like it wasn't like a manly pet or it wasn't a masculine pet. I never understood that. It never made any freaking sense to me. I'm like, the cat's like the greatest hunter, you know, not maybe not the greatest, but it's one of the coolest hunters there is. And to me, you know, people think of it as like the girl's pet or like the girly pet. And I never knew that stereotype growing up. I had dogs and I had 10 cats, and I never gave it any thought. And I know guys that think, like, if you have a cat, then that means, like, you're total sissy and, you know. And I'd also like to say, for the record, you know, we have nothing against people that are of any sexual leaning. I'm just making a point that for some reason this stupid stereotype is out there that's like a, you're not a manly man.
David has always had cats.
If you have cats, and I've never really understood that, because for one thing, and I love dogs too, I'm just saying, but I mean, dogs kind of like having a child. You know what I mean?
High maintenance.
Yeah, it's a lot. I had this one dog, and every single time, it would be the part of the movie I wanted to see. And waiting for it for, you know, an hour and a half, whether it was a good movie or not, you're just getting to that part. You're like, all right, let's wrap this up. And bam, that's when that dog would start barking. It just had a natural gift for, look at me, look at me. Nice dog, though. It had diabetes and a thyroid condition and needed 3 shots a day.
High maintenance, trust me.
It was a lab, little black and brown lab dog. But I've always thought that was funny, that whole you're not macho cat thing. I didn't really get it. anyway, back to our discussion. We're talking about cryptozoology. And our first extinct animal we mentioned was Honest Politician, since it was after Election Day. Or we won't say extinct, maybe we'll say rare.
Rare.
And I'm not one of those people that likes to say the things in the past tense, like, where did the honest politicians go? I'm like, I just think it's the nature of the beast. I think they've always been. People in power have to be watched. That's all I'm saying. And then we, of course, mentioned the dodo, Sasquatch, and to some aquatic animals, aquatic life. And they have and are discovering, like I said, last year, 18,000 new species had been discovered. So new animals are being discovered all the time, including large land mammals, which is, of course, often the ones that get the most press, that get the most attention. Yes. Or she said honest politician in the same line, laugh out loud. And there's another monkey they discovered that they said it sneezes when it rains. So it's like a way to tell it's like about to rain. This monkey will start sneezing. I thought that was kind of interesting. And as well as the new colorful, very shy and peaceful Lesula monkey that was discovered in the Congo last year, and some species of whale that had thought to have been extinct. There's actually two of them washed ashore in Opaque Beach in New Zealand. And we also discussed unicorns a little bit as well. And Janice and I were both up late last night, but
we're not extinct yet.
No, we're not extinct. And we're starting to look a little better, so.
We might be something related to the sloth. But,
just a little bit. We're a little slow and dragging.
I worked very late, and then I also was finishing a little bit show today, and as well, of course, listening to some election stuff. And so by the time it was all over, it was like 5 in the morning, which happens. I've actually considered bumping the show up an hour to 12, but we can talk about that later.
Yes, we can talk about that. But I was up until 3, and I usually don't stay up that late. I was looking at the elections, and I was writing stuff for next week's show, where we talk all about food.
Parasites, right?
Parasites and microbes, how good yogurt is, how not so good yogurt is. Candida, I hope I said that right, which is a form of yeast. And
you're interviewing, she's not going to be here for the interview, but you're interviewing a parasite expert.
Well, I have two people. I have...
I know the lady, by the way. She's really cool.
Yeah, she's a really cool lady. Anton Allen from the North Market, and the lady Josephine from Healthways.
Yeah, okay. Well, folks, we're coming down to it. We survived another Wednesday.
Yay!
Next week, the interviews won't be here on the air, but she's going to interview and then bring the information back. And I know the lady, she knows she's really passionate about the parasite thing. So I said, we'll give that some airtime then. Because every time I see her, she's like, parasite.
Talk to me. Parasite.
Treatments is clove. We'll get to that another week. They used to ask when you took your pet to the vet, parasites. But we'll get to all that information next week. This week it was cryptozoology. And I want to thank everybody for joining us.
Yes, thank you for joining us and helping us stay awake today.
And remember, archives can always be listened to, meaning that next week you can listen to last week, this week, on Main Street Universe in the archive section. In fact, I'm going to host our main archive section soon again, because some people get confused. All right. Well, thank you very much, Veronica. Great to have you.
Thank you, Veronica. Thank you, Marcy.
Thank you, Marcy. Here's Tom Teasley, Nights Over Baghdad. Have a great day.